And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John,
you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
Let's sell the book first. The name of the book is?
The name of the book is The Disappearance, Conspiracy, Revolution, Revelation, .. The Extraordinary Disappearance of Stephen Kibaki After 45 Years of Silence. Real long.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with why you're doing this now? All right, before we do...
Why am I doing this now? That's a good question. I'm doing it now. I'm almost 71 years old. I've kept this a secret for over 45 years, except for some friends and family. And I felt it's time to get out. And I think it's a great story that can be inspirational to people, especially younger people who are dealing with all kinds of issues these days. And I think is actually quite apropos for all the political and economic conflicts that are going on in the world.
Now you're a smart guy. How many degrees do you have?
Well, let me see. I got a bachelor's degree like most people. I have a master's degree in linguistics, and I have a PhD in clinical psychology.
So I should be calling you doctor, is what you're telling me.
No, that's not. Don't call me. I was a professor. My students had to call me Dr. Kibaki. Yes.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Are you retired or no? You're still working, right? You have a practice now.
I have a pretty active private practice. Before that, I was a professor for about 13, 14 years, various universities. What's
your area of concentration for your practice?
It's mostly adults, from young adults all the way to the older people. I used to work with kids a lot, but I gave that up because I got tired of dealing with the parents and the court system. But I used to do things like play therapy and sand trach therapy and puppets and all kinds of fun stuff. It's kind of
hard.
I really enjoyed working with the kids, but I gave that up some time ago.
I would imagine that the hard part about working with kids too is all you can teach is like coping mechanisms, because they can't influence their world.
What we do is something called play therapy, where the play becomes a way to working through whatever the issues are. So you might have in a dollhouse, you might have some child who, you know, the dolls are playing and the parents are beating up the child or something like that, or they're monsters. And so you kind of work things through and you then make interpretations to the child in the present. Like, geez, I wonder if this is sort of similar to what's going on with your mom and dad or, you know, something like that. But it's just a different way of communicating.
But then once you get to that, though, I've had a bunch of psychologists on.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Diamond does it.
Okay.
No. Good ones are really hard to find.
I think I'm one of the good ones, but
I'm sure you are.
Forget me. So.
I would imagine that, and I've said this. I would imagine that the challenge though is identifying the issue. Right now I know the issue. If I'm a child, I don't have the agency to change what needs to be changed. My dad drinks too much. My blah, blah, blah. I have, you know, so at that stage, it's coping mechanisms.
Learning to find, you know, other ways to be, you know, empowered, to connect with other people if a particular parent or somebody is not working for you, and then trying to get the emotions out. because by getting the emotions out, you can see them and you can better be able to cope with them and direct them rather than being overwhelmed by them.
When did you know you wanted to get into this field?
Long process. I mean, play therapy can take a long time. Sometimes I used to even, it's kind of funny, remembering way back when, I used to sing songs with the kid. They liked singing. Well, I'm just going to text message it. Yeah, frozen.
Yeah, my internet is wonky. I'll just cut that all out. When did you realize that this is what you wanted to do? Before the disappearance or after the disappearance?
Oh, way after the disappearance. We're recording now.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. So, yeah, it was way after the disappearance. My disappearance was more, you know, was a political conspiracy. That's what it was started out as. And my focus way back then, when I was 23 and before then, was on larger macro issues like economics and politics and sort of bigger things, not micro issues like therapy. Therapy is very, you know, one-on-one or families. So my focus then was on much bigger issues. And actually, way back then, I had kind of a disdain for psychotherapy in general. Though I actually read the works of Freud when I was in high school, not in German. Later, a lot of Jung. I really enjoyed, you know, that way of thinking. But I never thought I would become a psychotherapist. Let's put it that way. And then after I reemerged, I realized that there was an important part in my evolution as a person that was missing, and that was knowing myself and knowing what's going on with me interior wise, and then realizing that change not only has to happen at a larger macro level, but also at a kind of more micro personal level between people. So you have to change, you know, you at the same time the system changes.
Right.
And if you do one or the other, nothing happens. I mean, there's lots of people. Psychotherapy is great, helps a lot of people, but it doesn't necessarily change the way the world is.
True. How old were you when you disappeared?
I was 23.
Okay.
A few years back.
You look good, man. Don't say that.
Yeah, but it's been a long time.
All right. You're 23 years old. You're at Lake Michigan. Yeah. What happens?
Okay, so I was a student at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, and I don't know, it's kind of, you know, what, are you interested in kind of what led up to the development?
100%.
Kind of what
yep.
did that day?
100%. What led up? Absolutely, please.
Okay, yeah. So what happened was, over time, I began to read more about kind of what was going on, the economics in the world, corporate malfeasance, destruction of the environment. You know, that we live in authoritarian institutions. I mean, very authoritarian institutions, even NGOs, you know, are all pretty top bottom. We kind of live in medieval like structures. I mean, corporations are, you know, I hate to say this, but they're kind of legalized, you know, forms of criminality, you might say. They're kind of a gangsterism that's legal and protected by the courts. Corporations, of course, you know, are people. Yeah, right. Okay. That's how the Supreme Court views it.
Right.
And so they pretty much do whatever they want, you know, for the most part, you know, like this is getting way ahead, but, you know, back in 2008 with the mortgage crisis, you know, nobody went to jail, you know, none of those people went to jail. Nothing happened.
Fuck you.
But anyways, way back then, you know, things were fairly similar. There was a sense that, you know, that the world wasn't there for the people. Things weren't, you know, democracy was something you did every 2 or 4 years. And otherwise, we live mostly in authoritarian institutions. And somehow we get used to that. You know, there's reasons why. I think, you know, we are social creatures. We need hierarchy. We want leadership. But sometimes that really goes to the extreme. So that was something I was rebelling against. I remember,
man, sorry about that. That's so weird. Okay.
So, man, I don't know what's going on. My system's pretty good here. The connection here is pretty good.
Yeah, I don't think it's you. I think it's me. I don't think it's you. I don't know why that keeps happening. Sorry about that. Okay. So corporations are evil.
Yeah. You know, the usual. Yeah. And, you know, obviously a lot of, you know, long history of media around all that and books. And so I decided I didn't want to become absorbed into the system. I didn't want, you know, not that I couldn't do some reforms, but I wanted to do something bigger than that. Actually, you might find this funny. I went to a prep school called Deerfield Academy, which is a very prestigious one in New England. And I was sort of one of the poor kids. I worked in tobacco when I was 13. I worked every summer in factories or outdoors to, you know, buy clothes and help my family. And, you know, that's how I was able to buy, you know, sports jacket and tie, which you had to wear.
Yep.
So I worked while, you know, most of the people I was with, you know, they were out in Switzerland or wherever doing summer camps. Okay. So it was a pretty huge disparity that I witnessed. And when we graduated in 1972, we had a mock political convention for 1972. We had some senator from Alaska and a bunch of other people come. And, you know, and everybody was doing what they're supposed to do in a convention. And I and some other friends decided that we would kind of challenge the system. And we proposed all kinds of amendments to the Constitution. We were shouted down. And, you know, the gavel came down, "You are not in order," and all this sort of stuff. And they threw us out, essentially. They threw us out before we could do anything. And so, yeah, I had first experience of what it's like to, you know,
try to change something.
Up to the system.
Yep.
Yeah. It was futile, you know, because you wouldn't have any power. You weren't in control.
Right.
So power and being able to have access to power is important, but power is a double sword. I mean, it can be corrupting. But what we did, I and a number of people, we decided we would form a conspiracy. And the way to make this conspiracy work was I would disappear and develop a kind of underground resistance, a kind of people's army, you might say, people's revolution, hopefully a peaceful one. That was, you know, the focus is most, you know, hopefully would be peaceful. And I would get some martial arts training and a variety of other things. So I would go underground, change my name, disappear. And then the other three co-conspirators would then do things kind of in the more legitimate world. One would go into high finance and making tons of money, become a billionaire. Another person would go into politics and become a leader of some sort. And another person would go into theology, into probably more of a Christian theology, and lead some kind of movement in that direction. And the vague plan was that decades from that, we would all get together and we would then sort of be unstoppable because we would have control of the legitimate world and somewhat control of the illegitimate or the underground world of people amassing to want to make change across the world. And then we would be able to, you know, accomplish what we wanted to. So that was sort of the plan. And we call our organization the Nexilistic Revolutionary Front. I know that phrase front sounds pretty weird to people these days, but that was kind of common terminology back in the 70s. So then I disappeared on the frozen lake of Michigan. So one morning, I got my skis on. I used to cross-country ski a lot. I used to cross-country ski out on the lake. This was all very done intentionally. People knew I was, you know, pretty adventuresome and took risks.
Internet works. That should do it.
Okay. We'll see. Okay. It's okay.
Sorry about that. God dang it.
Okay. Let me see if I remember. Okay. So, in February, we decided I would cross country ski out onto Lake Michigan. And then plant my skis in my backpack and then walk back and go to Mexico. So that was the initial plan. Things didn't work out that way. Actually, we had a getaway car for me. And when I got to the getaway car, it wouldn't start. So I actually had to walk into Holland, Michigan and get on a bus. And nobody remembers that or recognized that. And took a bus down to Mexico. Well, not Mexico City, to Monterrey.
Right.
So yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that happen. You know, the book talks about interdimensional experiences, and I might want to talk a little bit about that now. Is that all?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, what we were doing was more politically, is a political economic calling, you know, for resistance. But there was also, it was also very multifaceted, you know, in many ways, we felt kind of a transcendental calling, you might call a spiritual one. You know, psychologically, we're both very driven and very intense people. You might say, yeah, you know, we had all kinds of hope and, you know, we were very idealistic, 23-year-olds, some older, younger than me. You know, we wanted to make the world a better place. We wanted to make a place, you know, that was more compassionate and loving, you know, not based on greed and accumulation of wealth and commodification of ourselves and everything. So when I got out on the ice, something surprisingly happened is that I had this immense dissociation, in part, you know, the person who left the ice, already had assumed a different name, his name, Nathan T. Stanfield. That's who I became after I walked across, left the ice. But there's another part of me that kind of dissociated and went into some, I don't know, interdimensional realm. I remember beings of light and kind of being in an energy shell. I was not abducted by UFOs. Okay, that didn't happen. Okay, you know, not, you know, the typical way people talk about it. But I think a lot of experiences people have are kind of more interdimensional or kind of between universes. And are not necessarily ETs flying overhead and getting it. I'm not saying there aren't, you know, flying saucers or anything, but I think the experiences of most people are probably more interdimensional and actually fits in with a lot of the history. If you look at more tribal societies, you know, they're, you know, more shamanic, you know, they would often have experiences, everyday people having experiences of connecting with forces or beings or entities in other worlds and dimensions, but they didn't, you know, they didn't think of it of them being abducted or something like that.
What was your experience?
My experience? Well, it's taken me a long time. It took a long time to recover because as I left, I was Nathan T, but there was a part of me that was elsewhere. It's kind of like I bifurcated, you know, and this kind of gets in, I'll answer your question, but this kind of gets into kind of what I'm really into now, and that's the multiverse theory. And in the multiverse theory, I think what I did is I entered another kind of dimension or reality. And in the multiverse, there are infinite number of yous and, you know, worlds and dimensions.
In the multiverse, you're interviewing me.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe. That's funny. But, you know, so, you know, I think that when we get into this sort of intense states, we can dissociate, and we see this in maladaptive ways. We call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, most dissociation seems to be negative, but in many times we're dissociating all the time. You know, like when you drive from one place to another, you can't remember how you get there. When you're having conversations in your head and things are happening around, you're dissociating. When you know, your dreaming is a form of dissociation. I think meditation is a kind of form of dissociation, getting into other altered states. You know, we spend a lot of time in dissociation. We don't spend so much time here. There are some meditations that are focused on being in the present and here, and those are very important because we need to be here, and enough people are not here or don't know how to deal with the here. So this experience of mine, I kind of entered this other dimension and, you know, I had this communication with these beings, but it wasn't like, you know, conversation. It was more like, we don't have the language to talk about these things. We don't have the science to talk about these things. And so everyone who has these sorts of experiences uses their culture and their background to make sense of it and actually to form and create the perceptions. So somebody else, you know, might have a similar, if something was similar, you know, they might perceive they were being attacked by lizard aliens or something, you know, but that may have been because they had no prior history of kind of understanding those dimensions. And so it was terrifying. And when you're terrified, you project into, you know, you project into it and begin to see things as they are. Just like in dreams, when, you know, people can have, like in Jungian psychology, you know, you can have a shadow figure, you know, coming after you, some dark presence, right, which I can talk about later with my own life. And in the Jungian perspective, it's part of you that you just haven't integrated, but you're afraid of. And then you see it as some like a monster or something trying to destroy you.
Right.
But so that's a projection of who you are onto that. So I think that's what happens a lot. That's why, you know, people, let's say, who are Christian will see Jesus and angels and demons. People who are Buddhists will see Buddhas and hungry ghosts. And people who are more shamanic will see power animals. And, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not saying these are all equivalent by any means. Okay. But my experience was one of, you know, kind of a more, I guess this fits with me, a more modern way of think of experiencing things. So I saw it in terms of light, and the communication was through light. And in fact, I almost felt I became a being of light. And there was, you know, like if you think of sound is a wave, and we communicate through sound, and there's a mathematics to all that. And light also is a wave, and there are different waves and different amplitudes. And my sense was communication was happening in this means.
What goes on in your life, though, at this point? Because if you disappear, the FBI gets called.
Well, no, they didn't get called. Actually, my parents, my mother did a FBI check, and I didn't want later. There's nothing on them. At least I don't think there is. Who knows what. But yeah, when I disappeared, it was a huge event. I mean, you know, they had divers looking for me, helicopters. I mean, it was a huge thing. And, you know, and I'm very sorry about this, but it was ruthless. What I did was ruthless. You know, I can rationalize it for, you know, I was doing it for a higher purpose. I think I was doing it for a higher purpose. But, you know, I caused a lot of pain for my family and friends. And you know, I still to this day feel bad about that. I did, after I reemerged, talk to my brothers and sisters and father and mother and some other people. And, you know, I seem to be more or less forgiven.
So you're in the, were you in the altered state the entire time that you were gone?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not really sure. There, you know, and since then I've had other experiences with beings of light, differently. And I've done a lot of things over the last 45 years, you know, in terms of meditation, in terms of learning kind of shamanic journeying and, you know, skills in that area. So things have changed quite a lot. So, but back then, you know, I try to try to understand as best I could. I felt I was being communicated to, that I was here for a purpose, and I think we're all here for a purpose. And the sense was that, you know, we need to do something to save our planet. That's the sense I had, that, you know, we need to do something. We need to move from domination and power and greed into something that's, you know, far more constructive and cooperative and communal and caring.
So your light, their light, were you giving guidance from this? Were you given?
Well, I don't know if you call it guidance. I mean, you know, I think we're always being guided. When I look at my disappearance, you know, when I was writing it, and, you know, there was a certain, you know, I got myself into a lot of fixes, and somehow I found my way out of them, because I was just, when I disappeared, I gave up my identity. I was Nathan T. Stanfield, and the only way to navigate the world was to be completely open to whatever was happening, and to sort of feel that energy, or that sense of kind of an intuitiveness of what to do next. There was, right, no, like, you know, there's no plan. You know, revolutions don't have plans. People think they do, but they don't. In fact, most, right, people's lives have no plans. I mean, the most important things in my life, probably like yours and most people, you know, were completely unpredictable. Good, right, and bad.
Right.
So, you know, history is like that. It's very hard. It's impossible to predict history, which is another little sideline, which is why economics is not really a science. It's at best no. history. And, you know, you get 200 economists together. They make some kind of predictions about whatever. And, of course, statistically, one of them is going to be right. And that mm-hmm. gets the Nobel Prize. I'm not trying to demean economists in general. I mean, they do good work in science. But there is no, you can't predict history. And that's one of the problems with something like a science. It's not a science, a pseudoscience like economics. I can go down that rabbit hole if you want me to.
No, I just want to piece the story together first, and then there's like 15 different.
I'm sorry, I'm digressing. I apologize.
No, it's not you. It's not you. So what made you decide to come back? I mean, you're gone 18 months. You're in 15 months. You're in Mexico.
I you... like 18 months, but it was.
you're in Mexico. You build this whole other life, yeah. And the plan is that you're going to meet up with the other three people. Did you have like a set? Did you have like a set? Like, hey, on October 28th, 2002, we're going to get together. And...
No, decades in the future.
Oh, okay.
Very long-term thinking. In order for people to amass the power and influence, et cetera, they would need to do, it would take decades. So this is a long-term thing. And what I would have to do would take decades.
Okay. Did you do what you had to do? Were you one of the ones that got to the finish line?
Well, that's the reason why the Next Holistic Revolutionary Front failed, is because I could not carry out my part of the mission. My part of the mission was, you know, to be underground. And, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, possibly become a real criminal or a killer. And, you know, and to really kind of jump into the abyss and become somebody very different than I really think I am at the core. And this is a major struggle through the disappearance. You know, in a funny way, you know, there's kind of a redemption theme. You know, there's a struggle between the light and the dark, and be that simplistic, but there is. And the light won in the end. I couldn't jump into the abyss and become what I now perceive as being kind of horrific. And this is what happens when, you know, the focus is on power and on, you know, the ends justifies the means. And, you know, of course, this is what rules our world. And we thought we were being different. But, you know, the problem is, you know, our, you know, what we were doing was highly secretive. And I think in the end would probably only recreate what was already there, maybe even worse. So.
Was your billionaire friend Elon Musk?
No. Unfortunately, no, not Elon. No. They're, you know, I'm still in contact with all the co-conspirators. You know, the book is written to change, all their names are changed. How I met them, everything is changed as much as possible to protect privacy. You know, and, you know, it's up to them if they want to come forward or not, but I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And, you know, when I reemerged, I feigned amnesia in order not just to protect myself, but also to protect all of them so they could continue with their lives.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, this kind of experience might have dramatically affected how their careers went or what they did.
Or sure.
What they accomplished, you know. And when I reemerged, I had all kinds of movie offers and all kinds of stuff. I declined them all and wanted to, you know, restart my life in a very different direction, which I was able to do. You might find something funny. I was just in Albuquerque, University of New Mexico, talking with one of my mentors at the University of New Mexico in the clinical psych department. And, you know, I was telling her that... when I was a TA in graduate school, that's around 87, there were some books, you know, introduction to psychology books that I was TAing one of them. And a student walked up and said, you know, there's something about a person who had amnesia and his name is Stephen Kabacki. Is that you? I'm there. What? Really? Are you kidding me? I mean, what do you think? Do you think that could really be me?
Yeah, hilarious.
It seemed preposterous, right? Because, you know, anybody like that obviously would not be in a PhD clinical program.
Right.
You know, et cetera. Because they're, you know, they're very hard to get into. You know, we had 7 slots at University of New Mexico, and, you know, I think there were, you know, 150 to 200 applications. So it's very difficult to get it. It's harder to get into a clinical program than it is to get into medical school.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Very, very difficult.
Probably good, though. That's probably good.
Well, I don't know. We need more therapists out in the world. There aren't enough.
We need more good ones.
There's some people out there who, you know, who can create damage. There's no doubt about it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I know, you know, I won't just go down that road. That's a whole other different topic. But when I reemerged, I wanted to just start a different kind of life. And so I did.
Did you, So you make the decision. You're gonna come back. You can't be the fourth cog in the wheel that'll make the whole thing move. So you say, okay, I'm just gonna come back. I'm gonna drop Nathan. I'm gonna to do that, you had to walk. Did you still have the same feelings? Did you still think the world's fucked and
That never changed. I mean, I'm still working on that. I'm working on some books. Right now, I'm almost nearly finished a book called The Multiverse Guides Humanity, which kind of looks at applying the multiverse as a model to help us deal with our conflicts in humanity, and how the multiverse works is very interesting. It has a lot to say to help us. And then I'm also working on a book called Planetary Economics and Governance for Earth, Moon, and Mars, which is a very different way of looking at economics. And it goes right to the, you know, starts with examining the very fundamentals of economics, like what is economics? And, you know, and right now the, you know, most economics begins with the idea of scarcity and all, you know, and rationality, which really there is scarcity is a human construct, and rationality for economic, I don't know if you know this, but rationality for economists is to be completely self-centered, completely self-focused and selfish. That's what economists believe is rational. They believe caring, loving, is irrational.
I can back you up on that in a sense, because I've known some people in high finance, and their degree of self-centeredness was frightening.
Oh, yeah. You know, and there's studies that show that when, you know, when people get trained in business or economics classes, they become less cooperative, less caring, and more self-centered. There is a, just like in any profession, you know, there's a training and a brainwashing that goes on to fit in with the values of that system and the assumptions that system have.
Right. Multiverse theory makes logical sense if the universe is infinite, right?
Yeah.
The universe has to be infinite for there to be multiverse, and then you have every possible outcome, you interviewing me instead of me interviewing you. You have every possible outcome. You have duplicate outcomes, which is something people in multiverse, and I don't know why, but they don't explore that part of it. If the universe is infinite, then this interview has happened an infinite amount of time, an infinite amount of times.
Yeah. One of the problems with the multiverse theory, the way you're talking about it, is and most physicists don't like this, is there has to be a balance between the infinite and the finite. So in another book of mine that is published called The Metamathematics of Existence, I and a mathematician developed 2 theorems that support the multiverse. One is the theorem of totality. It's based on Gödel's work, who was a contemporary of Einstein. And what that argues is that in order for anything to exist, everything imaginable, unimaginable must exist in some way, the multiverse.
Right.
The problem with that is you need something which we also developed, a theorem of boundary conditions, that there are limitations. You know, our world is not a fantasy novel. We don't have witches flying all over the place. And, you know, things can be bent and broken, but our universe is fairly rule governed in many ways. You know, you can't just do anything you want. You can't jump off, you know, the Empire State Building and think you're going to survive. You know, some people do, but you know, the odds are highly against it. Okay, so you know, and there are miracles. I believe in miracles. I've seen them. You know, there are things, but you know, there are limitations of what we can do. And these limitations are connected to how, again, how we perceive the world. You know, when somebody has a transcendental or a multiverse experience, how they perceive that and make sense of it is based on the limitations of their mind and their experiences.
But in a multiverse theory, there are universes where there are witches flying around, and you can create...
Sure, but not all. Okay, now, and this creates a problem is, you know, what can be transferred from one universe, from one reality to another? And we don't understand what that is, but we do know it's limited, you know, because otherwise, you know, things would be pretty crazy in our universe. Okay, now maybe they are, and we just don't know it. Okay, that's a
possibility. Right, right. I mean, that's...
Yeah. Possibility, but you know, the evidence suggests that that's not what's happening. That might be happening for certain people who access these things and experience them all the time. But overall, what's going on in our planet and the world, you know, follows certain kinds of rules and limitations. Again, these can be broken. They can be changed. I'm a big proponent of change. But we have to think about that. We have to see there's a balance here.
Does that contradict your theory that you can't predict history? If we have a limited set of rules and a finite set of conditions, at some point we ought to be able to predict.
Well, you're right. There might be a university where somebody probably could predict. I don't know, but it's not ours. Okay.
Right.
And you know, and the you know, this gets back into, and we'll go into, Gödel wrote two theorems called the incompleteness theorems and the inconsistency theorems. These are proven mathematically that everything in existence, all thought, everything you can think of is incomplete and inconsistent, contradictory, and always will be. And this is why we have change.
Walk me through the incomplete part.
For example, if you have an idea, a set of ideas, there's going to be something about it that's incomplete, something outside it. And because it's incomplete, it can't fully explain everything. And so then you have to go outside it and you get something else. And then you go outside that and you get something, and you keep going outside because in this going outside and adding is infinite. So
right. Things
are infinitely incomplete, and there's always contradictions. There are always going to be things in your ideas that contradict one another or can't explain. So this drives then knowledge and kind of who we are, and it drives us to evolve. You know, we're personally filled with contradictions and incompleteness, and this helps us to change over time.
I struggle with a part of that because when people say you use like 20% of your brain, for example, right?
Yeah.
I say, okay, in order to know that, I have to know what 100% is. So show me the 100% and I'll compare my brain against it, and we can drill down to 20%, right? Same thing with the theory of incompleteness. In order for me to buy that something's incomplete, I have to compare it to something that is complete so that I know. Otherwise, we are complete in our incompleteness, if that makes any sense. Otherwise,
No, you got a good point. The thing I, you know, my only retort to that is that we know through history and experience that there's nothing complete. You know, science keeps changing, literature, everything keeps changing. So the evidence out there supports incompleteness. There is no certainty. There has been no certainties. You know, certainties always get changed. Even, you know, if we look at a rock and it seems to be the same over time, it's because of all the relationships between the electrons and the molecules that keep it where it is over time. But actually, in terms of the Max Planck constant, which is 10 to the minus 34 seconds, it actually is appearing and disappearing. This gets into the whole idea of kind of quantum, where an electron, if it's not connected with, it's not relating or interacting with anything, can be and is anywhere in the universe. It's called a state of quantum coherence. When the electron begins to interact with things, then we kind of more know where it is and it isn't. And the more interactions, like a rock with everything interacting, then we know where it is almost all the time. it's not changing.
Right.
And this is, it just gets into an idea of quantum consciousness, which actually quite a few physicists adhere to and argue for. And in quantum consciousness, what happens is when we enter a state, our mind gets quieter, like in a dream state or in meditation. So there's fewer connections, especially with established chattering and thinking. And that creates a state where we can then access the infinite possibilities, the infinite worlds around us and the multiverse. And so there's, you know, you can train yourself in meditation and shamanic journeying. Psychedelics do that too. You know, dreaming, people have all kinds of, you know, paranormal experiences. And I mean, this is all very well documented.
I kind of buy into multiverse. If I buy into the concept of infinity, uh-huh. then I buy into the concept of multiverse. What does that do to purpose then? In other words, if I'm John Burton, if every possible outcome of me has happened, uh-huh. then what's my purpose? I've already accomplished me.
Yeah, you have. That's true, but that's abstract. The you right standing before me hasn't accomplished everything. Okay,
I have.
Has all kinds of stuff to deal with, like maybe, you know, your electronics not when you like to. You know?
Yeah, like your lifetime.
You know, so we have to start from a place of where we're at, and that is, you know, we live in this world that's finite. We do die; our bodies decompose. Not everything is possible. And in fact, what's possible is limited to what we can think is possible. And this is problem with the multiverse and also you get into religion is, you know, there's so much that is incomprehensible and will always be incomprehensible. It's beyond right. our understanding because we don't have any way we don't even know it's there. Never mind we think about it.
Where are you religiously then?
Religiously, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of eclectic. I borrowed a lot from lots of things. I think I like ascribing to the kind of a multiverse paradigm as an umbrella in which a lot of spiritualities and religions can fall under. Because in the multiverse, they have a real place. You know, there is a heaven. There is this. There's that. There are these places. Now, how people interpret them again is very different. But I think the multiverse creates a kind of scientific umbrella so these things can be talked about and maybe really scientifically experimented and studied. You know, someday we will be able to develop, you know, some way to enter another universe, kind of like, you know, in Star Trek, you know, or something. I don't know. But right now, all we are able to do is use our minds and get into the state of quantum consciousness so then we can access these places.
Right, right. Do you, are you married?
Yes.
Wife, husband?
Wife.
Wife, okay. What does she think about all this?
Oh, she's, you know, she's very supportive, you know. She's helped me with the editing the book that was published. Her name is Diane, and yeah, she's been great.
Do you have kids?
Fine. Pardon? Yes, I have a child. Who's in medical school. Actually, he's in residency right now and enjoying it. He actually enjoys delivering babies. That's his most favorite thing.
That's kind of cool.
It's all very positive, he says. You know, a lot of other medicine, not so positive lots of times.
Right.
Especially when you're dealing with people who have chronic issues and you know whatever you're telling them to do or giving them, either they're not going to do it or it's just a Band-Aid for, you know, for something more catastrophic happening in the future.
Right. Having had a child, does that bend your religious and philosophical thinking at all, or does it have no impact?
Well, I don't know. It's had an impact on me psychologically for sure. I'm sure,
sure.
You know, everything is connected. My son and I, you know, before we went to medical school, we did a lot of mountaineering. We've climbed in Peru, the Corralada Blanca, you know, the White Mountains there, 20,000 footers. We've been to the top of Mount Rainier many times. Actually, he and I have camped on top of Mount Rainier, which is not.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's still an active volcano and there are events, there are areas where you can see the steam coming out. Anyways, I've done a lot of climbing and mountaineering. That's one of the things I enjoy doing. I enjoy being outdoors quite a lot. It's my way to kind of get away from everything, you know. And so he and I have spent many times, you know, weeks with each other. So we got to know each other pretty well, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like, so I have a daughter. And I feel like when you have a child, you look at everything. I look at a microphone and parenthetically, there's my child. I look at a dog and parenthetically, there's my child. It's hard for me to be objective about, like, I would love a multiverse because I would just love my daughter to be forever. Yeah.
Well, she's forever because she's, you know, there's all these alternative timelines that she exists.
Right.
And you know, I don't mean to change this, but, you know, there's a lot of thing about the afterlife and reincarnation. You know, those are all interesting interpretations. My interpretation of all that from a multiverse perspective is that at a quantum consciousness level, we are moving from one self to another self. And so it seems like we're being reborn, but we're just connected already to a life that already is.
And
rather than being reborn, and how that happens, I don't know. I had some weird idea. I think I have in the book called Transdimensional DNA. There's no evidence to support any of that. But because what's interesting, you know, it has a lot to do with kind of where you're at in your personality. So, you know, when people talk about former lives or future lives, you know, they're always, you know, famous people or doing famous things or infamous things or something, you know, they're never just sort of ordinary people. And I think that's a lot to do with kind of where you're at and what you connect to. And so that's where you perhaps are, you know, that's what, maybe that is your next life is.
Right.
Life. But I think we have many, many lives. I think, you know, we've all been saints and we've all been horrible, terrible killers, murderers in certain realities. And I think knowing that, Buddhists actually talk a lot about that. The Tibetan Buddhists are very interesting. In that, you know, it helps us when you see that you've been a bad person in lots of places, it creates a level of some humility and some compassion for yourself and others to help us, you know, navigate so that we can all live meaningful and happy lives.
That drives me back to purpose again, though, because, and again, I'm pro multiverse, but then I'm like, okay, if there's going to be a bad John anyway, then there's 1,000% futility in me trying to do good, because there's going to be a bad John anyway. There's a universe where I'm, you know, Howard Stern. There's old Howard Stern. So what is the point of what is the point of, like, drilling back to one of your original themes, the idea of, you know, changing governance and changing economics? What's the point? Because we've already failed someplace else.
Well, yeah, but not in this world. We're in this world and, you know, we're part of this world. We breathe the air. We get hungry. We're motivated by all kinds of things. We can't help but be in this world. You know, you can check out, you know, if you want, or you can get involved, but you're in this world, you know, for a certain time of being, you know, and so we can't help but somehow engage in the world, you know, whether it's politically, psychologically, you know, whatever we're doing. And we don't have we can't predict our world, our universe, and its future. And so whatever we do can have an impact and make things better. Now, also, I think we can draw from information from other realities and universes and use that information, and it can be helpful. But we're in this world and we need, you know, do things to you know, I think what the multiverse does, it helps us see that there's a great diversity in the universe, and this diversity, you know, I think is a model for us. You know, when you look at an ecosystem like a desert, the diversity is not very great. Deserts can be destroyed very easily. But if you look at a very complex ecosystem where there's all kinds of life and vegetation and habit, you know, minerals and water and all sorts of things, those ecosystems are more adaptable if a change occurs. And human beings are more adaptable when they're more diverse. And if we look at an economic system works better when there's lots of diversity. Same thing with political. The more things get centralized, the less diversity there is.
Do you, having had experiences in other dimensions, where do you think human beings rank in terms of?
Yeah, I don't like to think that way in ranking. I mean, there are people who think, you know, there's higher beings. And then, you know, I think there's entities and beings that, you know, beyond my comprehension and have powers, but lower and higher, I don't know. I don't kind of get into that. I think one of the things to think about is that a lot what goes on in these places that people have visions or experiences cannot, you know, you can bring in some information and obviously psychological change, maybe even somatic or psychosomatic changes. But a lot what goes on in these places stays in those places. Because what goes on in those places is governed by the rules and the reality, everything about that place. And only certain things can be transferred. And so I think there's a tendency to think that, you know, anything from these other universes and, you know, whether it's heaven or whatever people are talking about is automatic. No, it's not. You know, we live in this world and it's governed by rules. Some of it can be transferred. I'm sure there are connections. You know, there's even speculation that, you know, dark matter and dark energy may have something to do with some other kind of universe or something. We still don't understand. Again, it's highly speculative. We're not sure what it is. But, you know, I think there, I have a little phrase that says what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Okay. And kind of what happens in the multiverse kind of stays in, to some degree, stay. Again, I'm not saying things aren't transferable, but they're not as transferable as people think. Again, otherwise our world would be a fantasy novel. And the other thing that's, you know, kind of goes along with that is people like to personalize everything. We like to think humans are the center of the universe. We like to think whatever's going on around us has something to do with us or is interested in us. Well, I think there are, you know, in other universes, entities or powers or God, whatever you want, that are interested in us. But I think a lot of it isn't interested in us. It's kind of like, you know, if you stand under the sun, you get warm. Now, is the sun interested in you? I don't think so. I think it's just warming you and you're accessing its energy. And I think what goes on a lot when people do, you know, do meditation, shamanic journey, whenever they get into, they're accessing things and drawing that energy. But that doesn't mean the energy is interested in them. Now, I'm not saying there aren't energies and things that are interested, but I think a lot of them are not. I think they could care less about us.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a personal and an impersonal quality to these other universes and realities.
Right. Do you pray?
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, praying is kind of a funny thing. They're praying and meditation. A lot of this stuff is, or shamanic work. It's kind of funny because I see kind of two paths with that. One, I call an open-hearted path where, when you're praying or you're just connecting with something greater and you're trying to do good and you're not asking for anything. You're just trying to connect and have this sense of joy and connection and try to, you know, do as much good as you can in the world or bring as much joy or happiness. And then there's another kind, what I call it more spiritual capitalism or spiritual bartering. And you see this a lot, like, you know, and if, you know, football, somebody will pray and, you know, they get a touchdown and then they thank God or something, you know, and I don't know if God is really interested whether you got a touchdown or not, you know, and that's a kind of bartering and banking system. You know, you do a lot of deeds and then, you know, whatever's up there is going to, you know, make your life better or something. Or you see this a lot in, you know, in kind of ancient sorcery and things like that, where you do something for something and then you've got to pay it back. So oftentimes a lot of rituals, offerings, things, you know, they, you know, and this is very traditional.
Right.
You know, there's a shamanic person I trained with a long time ago, was nearby. And, you know, his whole world is this kind of bartering between the powers that he connects with and what he gets and what he does for others. And then he owes them. You've got to pay back.
Yeah.
So you don't pay back, you can get in trouble.
So where are you on karma?
on karma. I think, you know, I think kind of what we do does can't, I think, again, I think karma is because is how we think of ourselves. If we've been very bad person, we've done very bad things, at some level we know we're not good. And that can draw us then to other places when we die. Again, maybe they already exist, but we are drawn to those. And,
right.
You know, and, you know, I don't know if, you know, karma, you know, oftentimes people who do terrible things over a period of time do get a payback. Not all the time.
Well, they don't get a, they, yeah, yeah. They get a payback.
It's not in this world.
But. There it is. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's more. What kind of music do you listen to?
Oh, it's just quite a variety, like old, you know, I'm brought up in the 70s. I listen to a lot of classic rock. I enjoy jazz, more modern jazz, some techno music. I go to opera. I love opera. I love classical music, but not, I like modern classical music. So Stravinsky and above, I don't care. You know, Beethoven's cool, but I don't like Mozart. Okay. Sorry to any Mozart fans, but
no.
I like Mozart. I don't like Bach. It's just all too formulaic. And I don't know. I like things that have a certain level of dissonance and complexity to them.
Right. What do you think your purpose is?
My purpose is to serve others. And I don't mean that, you know, kind of in a glib way, but my life has always been about that. And serving others and exploring the multiverse. That's what I enjoy doing. I enjoy exploring. I'm very curious, and I enjoy helping people.
And can you steel man the argument against a multiverse?
Pardon?
Can you steel man an argument against a multiverse?
You want me to develop an argument against the multiverse?
Yeah.
I think there are arguments already out there. There's a great book by Halpern called The Allure of the Multiverse. Just came out this year. He's an incredible astrophysicist. And he goes through, it's kind of like there is already a multiverse of theories about the multiverse. Okay, so there's a
right
gamut. Okay, there's one gamut, one side that says, well, there's this universe. You know, there are other universes, but they live so shortly and they're so, it doesn't even matter. It's just our universe. So there's that.
Right.
And then there's the other group way on the other end where I'm at. Where, yeah, there's infinite universes. Tegmark wrote a book in, I think, 2014 on the math on the multiverse. I forget what he calls it, something about the mathematics or something. Anyways, it's very accessible too. But his is a more radical version versus this very conservative. So people are kind of all over the place. Some people think there's 20 dimensions. Some people there's 100. Some people there's infinite. You know, there's just a lot of, you know, and it's great. It's what physicists are supposed to do, you know, try to, you know, figure things out. But it is so far all theoretical. And that's a problem for the conservative physicists and engineers is that, well, where's the meat? Where are these other universes? You know, well, you know, I can say, well, there's these experiences and these case studies and this, but that's not, of course, sufficient for science. But a lot of science, you know, if you looked at what Einstein was predicting and what was going on with quantum mechanics in the 1920s, all this was all theoretical. There was no support for any of it.
Right.
And, yeah. It takes a while for technology to catch up to test these theories.
Yeah. 15 years ago, an electric car was
right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's always bothered me, the limitation of the scientific method, because, you know, I mean, even in a lot, if I had told you a mere 7 years ago about ChatGPT, you would have laughed at me.
Yeah.
So,
but science can't answer everything. You know, that's why, you know, science can't tell you what to do with atomic energy. Do you use it for good things or do you build bombs to blow up the world? I mean, you know,
science
does not answer ethical issues, larger philosophical issues. It doesn't look at the values, and it doesn't look at any of those things. There's no way. Now, science can tell you, and it's very clear in the psychology field, that if you base your life mostly in positive emotions, not Pollyannish, but positive emotions, and then, you know, you're more likely to live longer and have a more meaningful and happy life. At the same time, you need to bring in negative emotions. You know, you need to get angry at times. You need to get depressed. I mean, all these are important emotions to have, but not to be stuck in them, not to have them chronic.
Right.
When you're chronic, then that creates problems, not only for you, but for someone else. Somebody might be chronically narcissistic or sociopathic. Well, we know what that results in. Okay.
And I know a few of those. Yeah, no, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, really, when you look at the bell-shaped curve of personality, it's a very small percentage of people who are sociopaths, but they seem to run everything. Well,
right.
The reason why they can is because the rest of us are caring, we're compassionate. I work with so many people, you know, in large corporations like Amazon and Microsoft who work 80, 90 hours a week. Like, why are you doing that? Well, because it's what's got to be, you know, they're altruistic. I mean, it's altruism. They're not getting paid for that. They're not getting paid like Jeff Bezos is getting and higher executives, but they're putting the time in because we are social creatures. We are very altruistic. We want to do things. We want to help others. We want things to work right, you know, but people, these sociopaths, there's no empathy. There is no compassion. They're absolutely ruthless. You are just a thing and to be manipulated and used. And they know how to manipulate the sociality in all of us.
Right.
This is what this is. And people can't see it because oftentimes they're very charming. They're very charming.
Right.
You know, can't, you know, you see, I remember working at a university once and God, you know, the charming people and they stab you in the back the next moment. In fact, I've been fired from a couple of places on too.
Yeah. Which party more aligns with what you think the path is politically?
Politically?
Yeah.
Well, I think we need to, you know, fight against authoritarianism. But you know, we need to look at it broadly because, you know, you pick on the Democrats, but you know, there's a lot of Democrats who, you know, are multi-millionaires and, you know, they don't necessarily want to lose their 10 houses or whatever either, you know? So
right.
You know, they may do, you know, from a Democratic perspective, they may be a little better to in diversity issues and maybe, you know, raise the, you know, what rich people pay by a few per more percentage points or whatever, you know, a little more redistribution of wealth, but you know, they're kind of caught up in the system too. And that's why you're having, you know, the big split now in the Democratic Party between those who want more highly progressive, you know, really challenge the system and the way it works. And those who are kind of, you know, yeah, a little bit we can change. So I think that's
right.
Problematic, you know, but authoritarianism is definitely one of them. And then, you know, we need to have a fair distribution of wealth, you know, people at the top. Nobody deserves billions of dollars. Nobody's that good and that smart. Okay. It's just, you know, the way our system works, you know, and, you know, accumulation of wealth, right place, right time. And, you know, inheritance oftentimes has a lot to do with it. And it's an unfair system. We need real meritocracy. We need accountability. And a lot of these executives, there's no accountability. You know, look at what happened at Boeing, you know, all the plane crashes and everything. And what happens to the executive? He gets paid tens of millions of dollars in a parachute. Well, thank you. See you later. You
know? Right. No, yeah. So, yeah.
You know, and I can tell you people at the bottom in these corporations, you know, there's no concern. Oh, we don't need you, man. You're fired. See you later. You know, they're, you know, absolutely ruthless. You think they get a parachute? Well, maybe a few months of severance or something, depending how long you work, but you know, nothing like tens of 20, 30, 40, $50 million.
Right. Anyways, right.
And all these boards are interlocked. You know, the people who are in one corporation are on the board of another corporation. They're all interlocked. This is why the pay raises for CEOs and higher executives keep going up. There's it's real obvious. You know, it's not rocket science here.
Right. I was just listening to Bernie Sanders getting interviewed, and he said he had this thing like that we should just cap it at a billion. Like if you make a billion, you're done. And you don't need nobody needs more than $1 billion.
Yeah, I would say nobody needs more than, let's say, 200. I don't know what it is, but it's far less than a billion. But what there is, I think we'd have to think about, and that would probably change over time. But, you know, nobody, you know, and you know, back in the you know, what made the United States great after World War II was there were incredibly high taxes. You know, people were paying 80-90% income taxes back then. That's
right.
That's what created the interstate. That's what created, you know, pretty much free access to colleges, you know, the GI Bill. You know, when you look at all the stuff that went on in the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s, it was because businesses and wealthy people were taxed at, I think, fairer rates. Now, you might say they were too overdone. Okay, we can argue about that. But now it's completely ridiculous. I mean, you know, we engage in corporate welfare. You know, corporate, you know what a corporation gets? I mean, you know, 20% taxation. But when you look at all the deductions they can do, they end up spending 5%, zero sometimes. I mean, you know, you can't, as a city, if you got a W-2, you're paying your 30, 35 or whatever it is. Yeah, maybe a few deductions, but no way. No. It's
right.
Corporate welfare is incredible. It's all over the place. And yet we seem to be accepting of it. It's
right. Bizarre. Yeah, I mean,
but we should get back, you know, the book, you know, it has a lot of, you know, I have a lot of different kind of spiritual adventures or multiverse adventures in it. There's, you know, I'm in Mexico and I go to Japan for training and near the end, I become part of the French Foreign Legion for a little while because I felt, you know, this is what I had to do. And, you know, and it kind of went well for a little while. I wasn't there very long. Because if you stay long, you have to basically sign a paper and enlist. And if you enlist, then if you leave, you're a deserter. So I never enlisted. But I did see somebody, you know, was in the mess hall, a person brought in and was beaten up almost, I think, to death before everyone. And that really shocked me. And that's what pushed me over the edge. And I decided I couldn't follow. I couldn't do this anymore. And I got out.
Yeah. Well, your experiences with inner dimension, is that something you can invoke, or is that just something that happens to you?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Something I've been working on is an idea I call constructive dissociation. And in constructive, it's like the opposite, I was mentioning before. In typical dissociation, we usually think of it as negative. You have a trauma and you dissociate, you know, something bad happens. Sometimes people have intense experiences like I did on the ice, and that's a form of dissociation or maybe multiverse bifurcation. But I think there's a way of doing constructive dissociation. That's what goes on in meditation. It's you observe and let go, and you dissociate in that way. And I think it's possible. Something I've been working on is when I go hiking, sometimes I'm hiking, I'm here in the present, but I can be somewhere else at the same time. And you can practice that form of dissociation.
Right.
You know, with some clients, you know, say somebody who's had a horrible car accident and they can't drive anymore, what I'll do is I'll have them imagine being in a car that can fly or that they're indestructible. And then, you know, the car can fly and things can smash. And somehow being able to do this in their imaginations, okay, it's kind of a form of dissociation, enables them then at some point not to have the fear, because there's some sense of mastery, even though it's unreal, that they're then able then to go in a car and drive through tunnels and things. I've worked with a number of people like that quite successfully.
Right.
So the dissociation is just dissociating from this universe to get into other universes or other realities. So we can practice. In fact, people do practice that. There's a great book. God, I can't remember the name. It's by an anthropologist who was looking at a Christian sect. And when people converted, a lot of people converted still weren't talking to Jesus. They just believed, they had faith. And what they would do is they'd sit around and have tea and imagine Jesus was there and they could talk to them. And if they practiced that enough, at some point they were talking to Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean, is it all psychological? Or, you know, I think, you know, if we look at everything we can imagine exists somewhere and somehow. So maybe our imaginations are a tool to get into these other universes.
Yeah. And that talks to visualization, which I think is fascinating. The idea that you can, if you can visualize yourself doing something, mm-hmm. you increase the odds of your probability that you're going to actually do it.
Yeah.
And like athletes do that, musicians do it all the time, but nobody stops to take a look at, wait a second, how does that work? Is my mind just what's the mechanics of it? Maybe you can explain it. What's the mechanics of visualization that, like, what's the cause effect? I imagine myself doing something and it increases the likelihood that I'm going to do it. How?
Well, the you know, it's still something under study, but my understanding is that, first of all, you have to learn to let go of where you're at in your head. You have to stop the chatter. So if you can't stop the chatter or whatever you're obsessing or thinking about, you can't visualize. You can't visualize something if you're worried and anxious. People are very anxious, have a hard time with visualization and meditation because their minds are filled with things. So the thing is to quiet the mind. So then you can then shift and go into these visualizations. So, you know, you might say a lot of spiritual practices involve this letting go or observing, which is kind of classical meditation, and then some form of visualization to enter something. You know, Tibetan Buddhism does that a lot. But we all do that. I mean, people will pray, you know, to Jesus, and then letting go and praying and allowing something to come, and suddenly there's a visualization or some kind of communication.
But how does that mechanically work, though? Like, the idea that, you know, it to me is incontrovertible. The idea that the power of thought manifests things. Mm-hmm. How does that work? And does that make us God? Like, I'm a guitar player. If I, before I go on stage, imagine myself, because, you know, you were talking about the car crash. If I imagine myself performing well, I'm going to perform better. So thought impacts reality.
I think that's true. But on the other hand, you can't be so performance oriented, because if you're performance oriented, it's going to create a lot of anxiety for you. So even if you do visualize, in the back of your mind, there may be this pressure to perform well. Because people who perform well let go. You know, like we're having a conversation now, and people who converse well are not thinking about what they're going to say. If you're already thinking about what you're going to say, you're probably going to get in trouble. It's like, you know, if you look at a sport like basketball, you know, if you start thinking when you're playing basketball, you're going to miss the shot. And you see this, you'll see somebody, you know, get 7 or 8 3 points in a row one game, and the next game they can't even get anything inside the bucket. You know, they can't get anything in because they're thinking, they're trying to replicate what they did before. And good sports is without thinking. We still access all our information and bring it to bear in the moment. That's what leads to great music and all kinds of, is this, you've got to let go of the internal and allow yourself to get into whatever it is your intention is.
Right. What do you think the future of America is?
Future? I have no idea. I think it's, you know, I don't know. You know, it's hard to know where things are going to go. People have all kinds of predictions. I really don't know. It's kind of hard to say. There's a lot of complexity in this society. There are lots of moving parts, and it's really unclear how all these moving parts are going to work out. You know, things might be fine. Things might be horrible. I'm not trying to avoid the question. It's really hard. I think the more we do to bring about good things, whatever you think good things are, then more likely we're to move in that direction. But, you know, I think if we look at the economics of the world, I don't know if it's, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, hope for AI and this and that, and there's a lot of optimism. On the other hand, what I see is greater centralization, more medievalization of our economic structures. You know, there's incredible debt. The debt is, you know, not just the United States, but everywhere, China included, the debt is incredible. We live in a fictitious economy. You know, there really is not much reality other than that people are okay with it. If people actually looked at what all the money that's out there in credit and whatever, and you looked at, well, how is that connected to like real things? What we value, there's not much connection anymore, you know?
Right. The other thing, like I kind of have a different view. I kind of think like it's very predictable what's going to happen at this stage of the game.
Yeah, what's your prediction?
AI is going to eliminate so many choices and so many possibilities that we go to universal. And I'm talking about America. We go to universal basic income, and we play guitar. because there's just not going to be anything
that
else.
Would be nice, but you know, I think I sort of agree with you that could happen. But the problem is our economic system is based on people buying things. Who's going to go for universal, salaries and stuff? You just think people at the top are going to be okay with this? We have a cult culture based on rising up to the top and, I'll be the next Elon Musk. And, people are very into this.
I think
all this welfare and socialism and I understand what you're saying. I'm not against it. I'm just saying
right. There's
a corrective
The model that we have worked with so far is predicated on choice, right? I have a choice. I can get to the top. I cannot, whatever, right?
Well, I don't think it's right. There's not choice. A lot of people don't have a lot of choice. I think choice is somewhat of an illusion. I think we do have choice, but choice you have to earn. You have to be able to do something.
But once AI fully blooms, what's the choice? I'm going to be a president of a company? There's no company. I'm going to run the stock market? There's no stock market. There's nothing to gain. You're going to have a job because you're a psychologist. I'm going to have a job because
AI can replace me. They're already trying to. You know, so it's already happening.
Yeah. So the whole our economy is an aspirational behavioral model. And once there's nothing to aspire to, and not that that's bad. Once there's nothing to aspire to, who cares? If a 38-foot Chaparral yacht in Long Island Sound, if I can 3D print that for what a bowl of cereal used to cost, because I don't need anybody to make it, there's nothing to aspire to. The aspirational component deflates, and we wind up either utopian or drunk all the time.
It becomes cheap.
Yeah, but is that? But it, you know, it, is that bad necessarily? If our basic needs are being met,
reality is a certain outcome. I don't, personally, I wouldn't like that. I think it's important.
You wouldn't like it now because you wouldn't like it now because there's still aspiration. But once there's no aspiration,
you're assuming there's a certain completeness to this, and I think there's a lot of incompleteness and inconsistencies about we don't understand, and I think there are going to be a lot of people who, kind of like reality and like surviving and like struggling. And struggling is good, and I think that's one of the problems, especially sometimes with younger people, is, from middle class and upper middle class families, is there's not much of a struggle. When there isn't a struggle, life becomes kind of unreal. It becomes unreal. And again, I told you I was working illegally when I was age 13. In the summers picking tobacco in 100-degree weather, under these tents and stuff, so I have a pretty hardcore work ethic, but it's because I had the struggle, and I think without struggle, I think that changes how you perceive things.
I think you're 100% right. And I think your book makes this point. There's something in the human condition that, is not, there's something in the human condition where status quo is never satisfactory. You could have not written the book. You could have just gone on and had your practice and climbed mountains with your son and done that. You could have not, and it could, there's an argument to be made like, why write the book? Who needs the hassle? Who needs to answer all the dumb questions? You got a good life. Right. But, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I think you're getting into something really important. I think, I'm pretty driven. I'm internally driven. There's nothing, nothing making me do any of this. Well, I do get a lot of reinforcement to talking to people about this. We are social creatures and we need feedback. We need, positive support, et cetera, that help. I don't need much to get me going, but I'm fairly internally driven. I think a lot of people are not internally driven. A lot of people are very externally controlled. They're controlled by the mass media, the culture industry. They're controlled by what goes on at work. There isn't a lot of self-agency out there. When you think about it, people are all trying to figure out, you know, how to be like somebody else or what I'm supposed to do, you know, or, you know, how do I kiss the ass of my manager or, you know, anyways, it's, you know, it's there isn't a lot of, there is some self-agency. There are people who are driven, maybe just biologically, their innate personalities or something. But, you know, our society, you know, there was a really movement from self-agency. I, you know, there's a lack of action, what I, you know, and the Greek word praxis, which is taking ideas and thoughts and making them real. And there's not a lot of, we live in a, you know, we live in an as if world. You know, we spend most of our time watching TV, you know, sports. It's all as if. It's, you know, we feel as if we're doing it, but we live in an as if world. And the more as if world our world becomes, the less self-agency is. And those who are in power and control of the as if world are the ones who can manipulate and control and direct things the way they want to.
Where are you on Trump?
Where I am on Trump? I
don't agree with that.
You know, it's a complex thing. You know, Trump is very complex. It's a very interesting character in what's going on. You know, there's, you know, you know, I think, you know, the thing is that, you know, there's a lot of people who are very pro-Trump. I have some MAGA friends and, you know, we talk and it's very interesting. And, you know, you got to read, you know, there's a lot of different perspectives out there. And I think the problem, though, is the lack of communication and connection. You know, when I talk to people who are far to the right, you know, and we get into like, what are they afraid of? You know, what's going on with them? You know, get into the emotions and some of the personal history. When you do that and you connect with somebody like that, then you begin to understand where they're coming from and they can understand where you're coming from. And then at least there's some communication and things don't have to be quite so crazily extreme.
Yeah,
and I think it's a problem, you know, and, you know, both sides have not been very good at this. Okay.
That's the truth. that's the truth.
You know, I know people who, you know, I've got some good progressive friends. They won't even talk to a MAGA. Like, what, are you crazy? Or something, you
know? Yeah, that's
no, it's terrible. It's terrible because
it is terrible.
Human beings, they care. These are people, you know, I have some, you know, I have one particular friend who would do almost anything for me. And he's very far to the right. You know, he would do anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we don't get at that level. And that's where we need to be getting at as you know, our human connections.
Not right.
Treating one another as things, as abstract ideas, which leads
right.
to dehumanization. When we humanize each other, when we see the complexity, incompleteness, the inconsistencies, the flawness in all of us, our inadequacies, then we can get somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for doing this, man. I learned a ton. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. You're great to talk to. Some interviews that are a little more like, I don't know, I don't feel like it's, you know, it's a little more herky. I don't know, but you, it's very smooth. I enjoy you. You're very easy to talk to. And I don't know. It's very nice. Thank you. I appreciate it.
No, well, I'd love to have you back on sometime if you're into it.
Okay, sure. Sure.
Awesome. To say the book one more time.
Okay. The book is called The Disappearance, Conspiracy, Revolution, Revelation, The Extraordinary Disappearance of Stephen Kabacki After 45 Years. I know that's very long. You can find it on Amazon. Just type my name in, Stephen Kabacki. You can also go to my website, stephenkabacki.com. And on there, there's a lot more about me, my history, what I've done. And also, I have on there a bunch of other writings on some books that I'm trying to finish that I've talked a little bit about today. They're on there too. So yeah, I think it's a fun site. So anyways, people are interested, they can visit that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again. Sorry for the technical problems in the beginning, but I'll fix that up. I'm going to hit stop, but don't go anywhere because your thing has to upload for like 2 seconds first. All right. Thank you very much.